listener production.
A warning. This episode contains graphic references to violence against women and children. Welcome to Crime Insiders Forensics. For those joining us for the first time, my name's Catherine Fox. I'm a former GP, crime author, and screenwriter. I'm enthralled by forensics and have spent thousands of hours researching for books and screenplays. So I thought, why not turn my research into a podcast? Every week, you'll be joining me in discovering how forensic science is helping solve high-profile crimes in Australia and around the world. This week, how a profiler from the FBI's Behavioural Analysis Unit used her specialised forensic expertise to help solve a double homicide.
And so I was kind of piecing back together. And so by this point, the shooter has shot one victim. The other one, he didn't have complete control over. She ran. So I thought, okay, that's leaning toward one offender.
What sets Julia apart from her colleagues at the FBI is her dual expertise as both a forensic scientist and a trained criminal profiler. This unique skill set has given her greater insights into serious crimes and the psychology behind them.
We're assessing, from a behavioral perspective, the facts, the circumstances, the evidence that are surrounding a crime, and looking at the behavior exhibited before, during, and after the commission of that crime.
To begin, Julia shares the story behind her transition from forensics to profiling.
When I was working in the crime lab, I felt like I was a very small part of a bigger investigation. So I think my first dream was I wanted to join the FBI. And I had a colleague who was a mentor to me, and he had joined the FBI about 2 years before I did. And I thought, I'd love to be in charge of an entire investigation and take all the investigative pieces and the forensic pieces and put it together myself. So I joined the FBI understanding that I may never be a profiler, but also with the understanding that I could continue with forensics by being part of the FBI's evidence response team. So I don't think I would have made the leap had I not been able to continue in forensics, because that is my true passion. It's how I started in this line of work of fighting crime. And so knowing those two things, knowing I might never be a profiler, but I could also still have my forensics and be a part of the evidence response team, I think that's what ultimately convinced me I could do it and that I would be happy making that leap.
How did the progression take place? So did you start working in their labs and study part-time or join one of their mentoring programs, or how did it work?
So when I first joined the FBI, you have training. At the time, it was 16 weeks of training at the FBI Academy, where they expose you to all different aspects of being an FBI agent, including firearms and tactical vehicle operations and the legal aspects. And so we do the training, but then they tell you, you're not going to have any choice of where you go or what you're assigned to. So my first assignment was to the Boston, Massachusetts office, and I was assigned to bank fraud. And so that's how I started. And then because of my background as a forensic scientist, I immediately applied to be on the Boston Division's evidence response team, and I became part of that. So I worked for about 3 years working bank fraud, and then I transferred to public corruption civil rights, and I worked that for about 8 years. But along the way, I was still part of the evidence response team, and then I also became what's called an NCAVC coordinator, National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime coordinator, which is a position in your local FBI office that is a liaison between state and local law enforcement in your area, or the liaison between state and local law enforcement in your area to the FBI's behavioral analysis unit. So that's a stepping stone. And then there was a position that opened up at the BAU in the Crimes Against Adults unit, which is the unit that I wanted to be in. And that's the unit that focuses, obviously, by its name, on crimes against adults. And it usually is focused on serial murder, mass murder, bizarre and unusual types of homicides, serial sexual assault, and unusual cases. And because of my background, not only in the evidence response team and having a violent crime background, because of that, I also had this white collar background. So that made me more competitive for this particular opening at the time. So I was very fortunate, very lucky that it was, the timing worked out for me, because it's a competitive position.
So you're not a psychologist?
No.
Psychologists look at people, make diagnoses of any mental illness, of their behavior patterns. You never get to see the person. You may not even know who they are, and yet you're building a profile on that person. So how does it work, Julia?
So some people have a background in psychology. We did have PhD level psychologists that worked in the BAU, but our job is not to diagnose. You're absolutely right about that. And we're not qualified to do that. Like, as you pointed out, you have to sit down and talk with someone. You have to be an expert. You have to evaluate them. And we just don't have that ability to do that. And that's not our role. So what we're doing is we're assessing from a behavioral perspective, the facts, the circumstances, the evidence that are surrounding a crime, and looking at the behavior exhibited before, during, and after the commission of that crime, and trying to understand or come up with personality traits and characteristics of the person who committed that crime. You're profiling an unknown offender. What are the personality traits and characteristics? And sometimes those personality traits and characteristics may be in line with certain mental disorders, but we're not calling someone a psychopath. We're not calling them a narcissist or attention deficit disorder or anything like that. But some of the characteristics we see in the commission of these crimes may be in line with certain diagnoses.
We wanted to talk about a case in Oklahoma where two young girls were murdered. How do you get brought in the first place to a case like that?
So, unlike how it's portrayed in TV and the movies, the FBI does not come in and take over a case. We have to be invited in. So, in this particular case, I'll back up a little bit. It occurred, the one you mentioned, in Weleka, Oklahoma, June 8th of 2008. And I had seen it. It made national news because of the age of the victims and the nature of the crime. I think people are just at a loss of what kind of person could do this. And I was thinking the same thing, what kind of person could do something like this? And so it was a case that I followed in the news for a few years. And this was prior to my assignment to the behavioral analysis unit. But when I got to the unit, part of our training consists of working cases in the other units. And as I mentioned, I was assigned to the Crimes Against Adults unit, but I also was required to profile cases in the other units, which included crimes against children, it included terrorism and threats. And so this was prior to me becoming a certified profiler. So I didn't have that piece of paper that said I was certified. I hadn't completed my training. But I had seen a media report that the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, which was the lead agency on this double homicide, was going to be requesting assistance of the FBI, and specifically the FBI's behavioral analysis unit. So I went and asked my supervisor if that could be a case that I worked on as my training. And they agreed. So I think I was assigned the case in 2011, the beginning of 2011. So it had been about 3 years since the homicide. So it was a little surreal to be wondering what kind of person could do such a thing and then have it be my job to figure it out.
Can you just walk us through the very basics of this crime And then we can get on to you examining the forensic evidence. Given your background, that must be a fantastic advantage.
Yeah, I think that is one thing that I brought to the unit was my background in forensics. And I thought this was a good case because for me to take a look at, because a lot of the cases in the Crimes Against Children's unit dealt with child exploitation. And I wasn't used to that kind of investigation, but I was used to homicides. And this case involved the two victims were walking down a rural road in Weleka, Oklahoma. It was a dirt road. It was only several hundred feet from one of the victims' homes. And this was a beautiful Sunday afternoon, and they were both shot to death with two different weapons. And they were just left on the side of the road in a ditch. And the father of one of the girls found them. And then her mother called 911.
How old were the girls?
They were 11 and 13. And they were the best of friends.
This is a small town.
Very small.
And presumably everybody knows each other.
Yes.
How did the town react to that?
Well, there was a lot of speculation and allegations made, and there were different theories. There was a composite sketch that was put out of a stranger that had been seen in the area, or of a person of interest that had been seen in the area, but nobody recognized the sketch. And then there were allegations that they were killed because they came upon a methamphetamine laboratory, or they were going to inform on somebody involved in criminal activity, or it was a revenge killing because the parents were involved in some kind of illegal activity. And so there were a lot of different theories that were, I guess, spread among the town and the area. And certainly, I don't think law enforcement thought those were valid theories, but it was certainly stuff that, you know, being a small area, people speculated.
How did the police handle the initial investigation and the crime scene analysis?
Very well. I have to say one of the challenges that first night where they started to process the scene, although it had been a lovely day, it did rain. So this is a dirt road, and so it was difficult. If there were tire tracks to cast, and so they had to put up tents, and so it made it difficult to collect certain types of evidence. But they did a very good job. And the one thing that I did notice when I was reviewing everything is there are lots of photos taken. And of course, I'm not there, and I don't look at this stuff until, you know, almost 3 years later. And the one thing that I thought was really well done were the notes that were taken by the crime scene investigators. So questions that couldn't be answered from just looking at a photograph, I was able to see notations made at the crime scene describing certain items of evidence that you couldn't necessarily tell from just the photograph. So it was very well documented.
You were doing this by remote from a distance at this stage?
I did it first. So they send you all the material, the crime scene photos, autopsy photos, investigative information, timelines, interviews that they've conducted, laboratory results. And so I started to review those materials. And then there were a couple things that I asked for, and those were that the investigators give questionnaires to people that knew the victims well, their friends, their families, their teachers, because that was the one thing I felt wasn't developed as much, and I wanted to know more about the girls, their victimology, to try to determine if they were involved in anything that could put them at risk for this kind of violent confrontation, or if this was potentially revenge, or were they targeted. I really wanted to know more about them. So that was the one thing that I asked them to do. And so having reviewed all that and reviewing their victimology along with everything else that was provided by the investigators, then I took a trip to Oklahoma and they took me out to the crime scene.
What did you find when you got to the crime scene?
What was really interesting is that this area, it's very rural. It was farmland. It was wooded area. And these are just a series of dirt roads, probably about 3 miles from the main interstate. It's well away from a lot of, you know, traffic. It's definitely a place where you don't just accidentally come upon this area. And so when I was being driven out to the crime scene by investigators, I told myself, I'm going to pay attention as best I can. And will I be able to get myself out of here if I didn't have somebody with me? Would I be able to find my way here and then get myself out? And I got lost very quickly because the roads don't even have names. They were numbers. And even in the 911 call, when the mother is trying to tell the 911 operator where they're located, there's a lot of confusion. And the mother's trying to give the number of the road and explain where they're located. I thought, this is not a place that just somebody comes upon. That's what I noticed right away. And then we got out of the car and we were walking down the road and we were walking down the middle of the road. And this was on a weekday. And they were killed on a Sunday. And what investigators told me is that on the weekends, this road, they did surveillance out there on a Sunday afternoon, and a car came by about every 5 minutes. And it's actually busier on the weekends because people use it as a cut through from one town to another. But during the week, people aren't really out on that road. And we were out there, I think we walked around and walked the area for about 2 hours, and the entire time only one car came by. And we were walking down the road, and I didn't even hear the car come right up behind us. And one of the investigators put his hand on my elbow to move me out of the way, and I turned around, and there's a car right behind us. I didn't even hear it. And I thought, this is very muffled, the trees that line the road. You just don't hear things. And I noticed as well, they had walked from one of the victims' homes and they were taking a walk to a bridge. And they liked to go to the bridge and they liked to throw rocks off the bridge. And sometimes they'd catch turtles and write their names on the backs of the turtles. And this was something they had done the previous day. And I just felt like this was such a safe area, such an area that these girls could explore and never have a care in the world. And the other thing that I had asked, because of the speculation about, well, they must have come upon a drug lab and they were going to report it, and so they were killed for that. And I remember asking the detectives, you know, well, how close is the closest drug lab that you've ever found? And it's like, it's about 5 miles away. There wasn't even anything close. So I'm starting to get an idea of this area. And there's not a lot of danger. It's very quiet. It's muffled. The access mostly are going to be locals. I found it very hard to believe that some stranger just came off the main road. And that was one of the things, that's one of the questions I wanted to answer for investigators. Was this a local person or was this truly a stranger? And I really didn't think it was a stranger just based on my visit there.
Do you think the woods are the reasons that the family 200 meters down the road didn't hear gunshots?
Yeah, well, you know, I do believe that that's the reason, but I do think too there were certain areas where people did hear gunshots. So I think it was strategic, depending on where you lived or were located in that area, you may or may not have heard the gunshots. And so some people did report hearing gunshots. However, this area, nobody thought twice about that because they hear gunshots all the time. People are hunting, people are target practicing on their property. I mean, this is farmland. This is not a densely populated area. So like maybe on one side of the road, you might have heard the gunshots, and then on the other side, you might not have heard them. But yeah, I do think that it prevented at least her family from hearing gunshots. And then those who did hear them didn't think anything of them.
Because guns are part of the culture of living in that area.
Very much so. Yeah, very much so.
Of the population, how many would have been familiar with guns?
One of the things that I had told investigators, and this was based on my analysis that, you know, in terms of kind of recreating what happened, this was somebody who was a very good shooter. He was very accurate, and he fired in a high-stress situation. And one of the girls had turned to run. And so he hit a moving target, and he hit a moving target multiple times. And then I determined that likely he stopped shooting with that gun, which was determined by the laboratory to be a, most likely a Glock 40 caliber weapon. And then he went and got another gun, which was a 22, and then shot them both again. So I was thinking, this is somebody who is familiar with weapons, likely practices with them. And I think at one point I had told investigators, he's a gun nut. And they started laughing at me. And they're like, this is Oklahoma, ma'am. Everybody has a gun. So statistically, I don't know how many people would have been familiar or would have had guns, but a lot. It was not easy to just determine, okay, this is a person in our area who has guns, and so let's go talk to them. This would have been a lot of different people.
What made you think that there was only one shooter, not two?
And that was one of the questions I did want to answer for investigators, because many of the investigators thought there had to be two shooters. And the reason I determined that it was most likely one shooter, you're never 100% about anything, by the way, when you're profiling, but most likely because taking into account the crime scene and the autopsy findings, and I was able to kind of piece back together a sequence of events that I thought were the most likely sequence of events. One of the victims was shot first, and it was clear because she was able to react. She put up her hand, and she had a defensive wound. I think the bullet hit her hand. It fractured, and then a part of that hit her in the face. And some people speculated, well, she must have been punched in the face. But I think it was she had a, you know, broken bones in her hand from having deflected it, and I think a piece of the bullet hit her in the cheek. And so I believe she was shot first. And then the other victim had a chance to run, and she was running, and then she was shot like in the back, and she was shot in the back of her arms. And then she was also shot in the side, which the medical examiner said would have been immediately fatal. And so I was kind of piecing back together. And so by this point, the shooter has shot one victim. The other one, he didn't have complete control over. And so she ran. So I thought, okay, that's leaning toward one offender. If you had two offenders, they might have had better control over the victims. Then the offender likely went and got a different gun. And I believed he was most likely in a vehicle and went and got a different gun, a 22 caliber, and then shot them each again. And so looking at that, I thought there was nothing that had to have happened simultaneously, where you had to have two people. And so statistically, when you have two victims, you have one offender. And because I didn't see anything that indicated to me that there had to be more than one offender, I just kind of relied on statistics. It's likely one offender, because one offender could have accomplished this. So that was why I said it was one offender. And even at the time, I'm not sure all the investigators agreed, but they don't have to agree. It's their case. I'm just there to provide my assessment, and they can kind of take it or leave it and use what they, you know, use what they find helpful and toss out what they don't want to use.
Well, that raises a couple of questions just for me. Who carries two guns, not just one gun, in a car? And the second question is, why would you change guns?
Mm-hmm. When it came to having the two guns, and that's kind of why I thought this is a gun nut, because I wasn't talking about the hunters or the people who shoot for sport that have gun racks in the backs of their trucks and they carry their guns. This is a Glock 40, which is a handgun, and a 22. We didn't know what kind of gun it was. And I didn't think it was that when I said a gun nut. I thought this was somebody who was always carrying around at least a Glock and at least a 22, and people would know this about him. And the reason why I thought that, I found that they were very low-risk victims, and there wasn't anything in their life or their lifestyle or their family's life or lifestyle that put them at a higher risk for something like this to happen. So I really felt that the motive for killing them was formed on that day. This wasn't some revenge killing. This wasn't, they weren't going to meet anybody because they didn't have access to computers or cell phones. One of the victims did have a cell phone, but it was determined she only ever communicated with her parents. They didn't have access to computers at home. They only used computers at school for homework. And so they're very low risk. And so I thought, okay, this person wasn't planning to kill them. So something happened on the road that day. And therefore, this person likely is always carrying these two particular guns with him. And I'm not talking about these like hunting rifles that we see that people carry. These are, you know, a Glock is a little different kind of weapon in terms of it's not necessarily used. At least when I was growing up, a gun like that wouldn't be used for hunting. And I grew up in a rural area where we had a lot of hunters and people had a lot of guns and they stored the guns on their walls in their home. And this was not the kind of person I was talking about. So I thought either the first gun either malfunctioned, because based on what we know about the Glocks, it didn't fire as many rounds as it could have held. So either it wasn't completely loaded or and he shot all the rounds that he had, or it malfunctioned, or the last theory was he shot them, he got back in his car, and for whatever reason felt like, I need to make sure that they are dead. I cannot leave them alive, because whatever happened that day, he couldn't leave them alive. And so he just grabbed another weapon and then used a different weapon. So those are my theories, like my three different theories as to why. But it really did appear that he shot them with the one gun and then went and retrieved another one and came back and shot them again.
Did he move the bodies or try and hide the bodies at all?
No. There was some indication potentially that one of the victim's legs could have been moved, but she also could have fallen in that position. But from what I was looking at, I didn't really see that the offender had any significant interaction with the victims, and neither victim was sexually assaulted.
Does that change your concept of the motive for the killing then?
It did. I felt like there had been some kind of interaction. And I didn't feel, just because of there was no indication of any kind of other injuries to the victims, there was no indication that there had been a real struggle between the offender and the victim. And keeping in mind, you know, the crime scene had been slightly ruined because of the rain, so it was hard to tell exactly if there had been, you know, a lot of struggle, but it didn't appear that there had been a struggle. So I didn't feel like the offender had attempted a kidnapping. However, based on their age, I thought there could very well be a sexual component to it, but I didn't feel that this was a kidnapping or a sexually motivated homicide as we know them to be. It didn't have that feel to it to me, just based on what we were seeing at the crime scene. And there was no theft. One of the girls was carrying a bag that had some belongings in it, and that was still right next to her. So I just felt that there was some kind of interaction. I didn't know what that was. And the offender felt like whatever that interaction was, he couldn't let the girls go back home and tell their parents what had happened.
So that's an incredibly intriguing and disturbing at the same time. Presumably the police then would initially look at sexual offenders. But if that offence isn't necessarily the motivation for the crime, then your pool of suspects must grow dramatically.
Yes. And they had interviewed so many people. So many people that I even told them that I believe that they had likely already interviewed the offender. Because one of the things that they had done is they were trying to track down anyone who might have owned or at one point purchased a Glock 40 caliber weapon. And they were going out, and this was not an easy task. There were many people, and they were going and interviewing them. And I thought, likely, just based on the scope of their investigation, they likely talked to the offender.
Were they mostly interviewing local people?
Yes. Throughout the state of Oklahoma, anybody who had a Glock, even if they didn't live locally, they would interview them just to make sure. But the majority of their interviews were local, just because this is where the girls lived.
Did you go through any of those interviews?
I did go through a lot of the interviews. I didn't go through all of them. I don't think that I had access to every single interview. But after a while, there's a lot of speculation in the interviews. Well, I think this happened, or I think that happened. And they hadn't really narrowed down any particular person that they really suspected. And if they had, those are the interviews I would have wanted to have seen. But I really sometimes find that unless they're really close with the victims and they're providing a lot of victimology, sometimes the interviews can get a little confusing to me, or it can muddy the waters, so to speak.
Was there any that stood out to you?
There was one interview that did stand out to me. And based on what we learned about this individual, I thought he should be prioritized as a suspect in the case. The one thing, though, that investigators, and I agreed with them, is that he was much older than I think what we thought, because the Glock 40, investigators felt like it was a younger person because of the weapon. And the one person who lived in the area that had a lot of the same kind of characteristics that I was describing, particularly this lack of empathy and this emotional immaturity, this person really fit. And this person had also interacted with the victims in the past. So he seemed like a suspect that could not be ruled out. But it was not him. It turned out that was not him, which goes to show how this is not an exact science. You need the hard science to help make your case, like forensics. And the good thing about it is that the crime scene, they found several shell casings from the 40 caliber weapon. And so they did have forensic evidence tying at least a weapon to the crime scene.
They just needed to find that gun.
Yes, find the gun, find potentially shell casings that match. One of the things I thought was this person practices with his weapons. He's a good shot. He probably brags about it. So one of the investigative suggestions that I gave is to maybe go to shooting ranges and ask and inquire about people who come to their range, and do you have anybody who fits this profile? But that was one of the suggestions that I made, because I felt he practiced, that he liked to shoot, and he practiced a lot. So when they laughed at me about, ma'am, everybody in Oklahoma has a gun, I had to explain that's not what I mean. This is more of an obsessive person who is going to brag and boast. The other thing that I felt strongly about, just based on what I observed at the crime scene, is when you think, these are very low risk victims, what on earth could cause somebody to do what this offender did to these girls? And I'm like, there couldn't be anything in the world for most people that an 11-year-old and a 13-year-old girl could do that would cause anybody to kill them. And so that takes a very distinct personality, a very cold-hearted personality. So I felt that people who know this person are going to know that he's dangerous. He's probably overreacted to certain situations, to perceived slights, that this is going to be a major component of his personality. And once he's identified, people are going to come out of the woodwork starting to tell stories about how dangerous they felt this person was. And so this is not your local hunter with a hunting rifle in his truck. This is somebody who is very dangerous and very scary. And that's where I really wanted them to focus on, that personality. And I said, when you find that person, when you start hearing stories about a person who has done something really horrible to other people, that's who you're looking for.
Not everybody reports assault, so that makes it even more difficult, particularly intimate partner or family violence. Were you then looking at previous crimes, assaults?
One of the things that I had suggested is they go back over people that they had had contact with, particularly anybody who had the weapon that they were looking for. And they hadn't been able to contact every single person that they thought would have a Glock. They couldn't locate all the weapons. But taking these characteristics and going back over and looking at people that they've talked to and kind of overlaying that profile and, you know, asking these questions, have they ever done anything that was unexpected? Do they overreact to things? Have they ever lashed out at you for something that seemed very minor? That these are the types of people that you are looking at. So when you're starting to look at people that maybe have these particular weapons, do they have these character traits in their background? They might not necessarily have a criminal history. They might not necessarily have ever killed anyone before, but these are going to be characteristics that are reflected in their interpersonal relationships.
Did that give them any leads?
What ended up happening is an offender or a suspect came onto their radar because there was a young woman, she was 23 years old, who went missing. And she was supposedly going off to get married to her boyfriend. And his name was Kevin Sweat. So ultimately, investigation showed that Kevin, rather than going off and marrying her, he murdered her and burned her body on his grandfather's property, which was right near the crime scene. And he lived near one of the victims, the two girls. And during the interview of Kevin, the investigator said, he matches the profile. I think he killed the two girls as well. And he happened to be the same investigator that was the lead investigator on the two girls. So I got a phone call, and the investigators were telling me this guy matches the profile. And this was just a few months after I had been out to Oklahoma. And my initial response was disbelief in a way. I trusted them. I knew they were good investigators, but I also started thinking, I hope they don't have tunnel vision and think that everybody's going to fit, because I just thought this can't be happening so soon. And they have a suspect sitting right in front of him. And so as they started learning more information about him, they sent me pictures of him. And this guy, Kevin Sweat, had posted pictures of himself online posing with his guns. And they were very artsy types of photographs. And he certainly seemed to have this fascination with weapons. And when I saw the photos, I like, that's what I was talking about. Maybe I didn't articulate it right that you're going to have him posing with his guns. But when I said that this is somebody obsessed with weapons, this is what I was talking about. And I just had this feeling, this is going to be him. And then they ended up doing a search warrant on his grandfather's property. And they found, or his father, I think it was his father's property. I can't remember if it was his father or his grandfather. But they found shell casings. And they found a makeshift gun range where somebody had been doing target practice. And the shell casings on the property matched the shell casings at the crime scene.
When you heard that, how did you actually feel?
It's a combination of exhilaration and sadness and relief. Certainly my role in an investigation like this, I'm detached. I'm not talking to victims' families. I'm not talking to the victims' friends. I'm not involved. I don't live in the community. So any happiness I have is for the investigators that do this kind of work day in and day out and spend their lives on these cases. And so I just felt very happy for the investigators as well, because I knew what a relief this was to them.
Your involvement didn't end there though, did it?
No, it didn't.
What did the police then ask you to do?
An interview strategy.
How do you set up an interview with someone who you think has no empathy? How do you make a strategy for the person doing the interviewing?
Well, certainly somebody like that, you can't really play on their emotions in terms of making them feel sympathy or empathy for the victims. Anything he says is going to be because it benefits him in some way. You know, so you have to kind of play into that. The other thing that we knew is that the original investigator who had interviewed him the first time about the death of his fiance had built a fairly good rapport with him. And he did admit to killing his fiance, but he also sort of played like he was seeing things and he was crazy in a way. Even though he made admissions, he wasn't being accountable for what he did. He was saying, I saw things and it's, you know, my mental illness made me do it, is basically what he was saying. So one of the things I told the investigators, you know, I felt like the same investigator should interview him again because they have an established relationship and he's already admitted things to him in the past, and that if he tries to claim any kind of implausible thoughts or things, don't argue with him, just let him tell you the story and certainly make it about him and not about the victims. And so ultimately, when he was interviewed, he told the investigator that he was on the road that day. He pulled over because he, and I'm going to quote him, needed to take a leak. And while doing so, he saw monsters coming at him and he had to shoot them. And then he got back in his car and then the monsters came at him again and he had to shoot them again. And so that was the story that he told. He didn't really move off that story. So it was an admission. He admitted to being there. He admitted to killing them, although he was blaming it on, you know, delusions. But the other thing that I thought was really important about his admission was that the sequence of events that he described were what I believed had happened and what I had written in my report. And only the offender would know that. Only the offender would know how it played out. And even though it wasn't a pure confession, the investigators and the prosecutors felt it was a confession, even though he tried to say he was, you know, mentally ill at the time. But there was no indication that he was. He was evaluated and determined to be fit to stand trial.
I thought when you said he needed to pass urine by the side of the road, is that a euphemism? Is that some sort of excuse for him exposing himself?
I believed it to be. You know, what he's admitting to, when we kind of look back on behavior and what is he saying, he's saying he exposed himself. Because if he was relieving himself on the side of the road, he would require him to expose himself to do so. So that's what he's telling us. And so what I believe likely happened is he exposed himself to the girls, and they either recognized him, because there was a connection. One of the girls' sisters had worked with him in a fast food restaurant at one point in time. So either one of them recognized him and said they were going to tell on him, or he just felt like, you know, they're going to tell on me, so I just have to kill them. And I think that that's what the motive was. And I think for a lot of people, that's hard to believe, that it could be something so minor like that. But for somebody, this personality type, it's not minor. And one of the stories that investigators learned from a prior girlfriend of the offender was she was on the telephone with him at one point and was trying to break up with him. And he told her on the phone, well, I'm going to kill myself. And he fires a gun. So she's on the other end of the telephone thinking he's just killed himself. And she's horrified and she's screaming. And he gets back on the phone and he laughs. He says, what's the matter? I was just joking. What's wrong with you? And that's what I'm talking about when I talk about this abusive behavior that's shocking to people. This is the kind of person that would do what he did to these two victims and to his fiance. These are the types of behaviors that you'll see, these really shocking, unexpected behaviors. I'm not saying that everyone will do something exactly like that, but this really abusive and tormenting behavior that he had no qualms about engaging in, to horrify somebody just to punish her for not wanting to date him any longer. And there's no indication that he's killed anybody else other than these three people, but he would have killed again, I believe. And certainly if he was in any relationships with anybody else, it would have been extremely abusive, emotionally and likely physically abusive as well.
What astounds me is that somebody like this, who you sort of, his lack of empathy, it's a dysfunctional personality, really, his overreacting, it's not going to endear to many people. And how on earth then does he have relationships with females to the point where he was engaged to one? He must be able to fake it, and yet he couldn't fake it in a police interview.
Yeah, he was very good at faking it. I mean, he did date women, but at first, it's like anyone else, he seemed just fine. Seemed like a nice guy, charismatic and polite, and came across that way right at first. And then he'd get involved in these relationships, and then this other side would come out and he would be extremely abusive. And it can be very difficult once you're involved in a relationship like that to get out of that relationship, particularly with someone who's so manipulative and frightening. Yeah, the other thing that I thought was really interesting, he would talk on the phone with his mother, and the investigators were sharing his jail calls with me so that I could get a better understanding of him. And prior to being charged with the murders of the girls, he'd been charged with the murder of his fiance, but he had not been charged with the murder of the girls. But his mother, he's on the phone with his mother, and his mother tells him, you're going to be charged with those murders. And his response to his mother was, what is this going to do to my reputation? So that was one of the things I said, use that in the interview. Use this would be good for your reputation if you tell the truth, and things like that. But it really did seem like that was his concern, is his reputation.
And yet he was in prison at that time for killing his fiance.
Right. Completely out of touch with the perception of who he was. Completely out of touch with reality. Not in a crazy way. He knew right from wrong. He definitely knew right from wrong. Or if he didn't, I don't think he would have killed the girls, because he wouldn't realize what he was doing by exposing himself was wrong. And I should say, he's never admitted to exposing himself to them. Like, he's never admitted to that as the motive. That's what I think is likely the motive, just based on what he did say.
You can explain what he's done, but do you understand it?
No, I don't understand. A lot of times I think you see on TV and movies that profilers or investigators, they get into the minds of the killers, and I really don't do that. I don't think I'm capable of getting into their minds. I can explain things. I know logically there are people out there that can do things like this. I can explain it in a logical way, but in my heart, do I understand it? I don't understand it. I don't know that I ever will. I certainly wouldn't want to know those feelings, no.
Julia, this has been incredible. And thank you so much. I can't believe you're across the other side of the world and yet we're just chatting away.
I know.
So we've known each other for years. Thank you so much for all your incredibly informative information and storytelling, and for making a difference, particularly in this case.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's my first international podcast that I've ever been on, so I'm truly honored. Thank you.
Crime Insiders Forensics is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Catherine Fox, and is produced by Ed Gooden. Sound design and imaging is by Link Kelly.